The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job has just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer.
But welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Vivi Ganeshanathan. Vivi Ganeshanathan is the author of the novels Brotherless Night and Love Marriage, which was longlisted for the Women's Prize and named one of the best books of the year by the Washington Post. Her work has appeared in Granta, the New York Times, and the Best American Non-Required Reading, among other publications. She co-hosts the fiction nonfiction podcast on Literary Hub, which is about the intersection of literature and the news. And her new novel, Brotherless Night, is set during the early years of Sri Lanka's three-decade civil war and is a heartrending portrait of one woman's moral journey and a testament to both the enduring impact of war and the bonds of home. Welcome, Sugi.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is so exciting. I loved your book, and I feel weird saying it like that because, as I said to Alex, I think on our last episode, it's a page turner.
Mm-hmm.
As much as one can be, that's also incredibly devastating and, set during war, set during the Civil War. But it is beautiful and it's an epic, and I just feel so lucky to have read it. So excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for reading it. And it's nice to hear that it's a page turner.
It really is. I couldn't stop. But again, that feels so morbid to say, because it's really sad. It's really sad.
It is.
And violent and devastating. I learned so much that I didn't know.
Same.
So I feel really, really glad that I got to read it, but please read to us from it so we can give our listeners a little taste.
Sure. So I'm going to just read from the beginnings, which doesn't require so much setup, but I will say that the beginning the book is in first person. It's from the point of view of a woman named Sashi, and she is from the point of view of New York in 2009, recalling her life kind of is from the middle of her teenage years for about the next decade. So it's retrospective first person. And I will start from that prologue, New York, 2009. I recently sent a letter to a terrorist I used to know. He lives near me here in New York City. And when I opened the envelope and slid in the note that said, "I would like to come and see you," I thought of how much he had always required of me and how little I had ever asked of him. Even when I was growing up in Sri Lanka, before I had ever heard the word terrorist, I knew that if a certain kind of person wanted something done, I should comply without asking too many questions. I met a lot of these sorts of people when I was younger, because I used to be what you would call a terrorist myself. We were civilians first. You must understand, that word, terrorist, is too simple for the history we have lived. Too simple for me, too simple even for this man. How could one word be enough? But I am going to say it anyway, because it is the language you know, and it will help you to understand who we were, what we were called, and who we have truly become. We begin with this word. but I promise that you will come to see that it cannot contain everything that has happened. Someday the story will begin with the word civilian, the word home. And while I am no longer the version of myself who met with terrorists every day, I also want you to understand that when I was that woman, when two terrorists encountered each other in my world, what they said first was simply hello, like any two people you might know or love.
As I was listening, I was reminded about one of my favorite aspects of this novel, and I had forgotten that it was right there in the prologue at the very beginning. There is a direct address quality to a lot of the at the start of a lot of the chapters throughout the novel, as well as just in important moments of transition. And I feel like so often in novels, a kind of direct address, addressing the reader with a you, making the reader doubly aware of the story being told, often is used to foreground the fictional aspects of a novel or a character's narrative. But in the case of Brotherless Night, it's the opposite. It seems that the tactic is to remind the reader that the events that this novel is pulling from and based on are very real. And I was wondering if that kind of address that recurs throughout the novel was something that was there from the very start, or something that you built back in later on.
Sure. I guess it was there from the very early drafts of the book. And I think, so some of the first sections of the book were, I mean, this page was in some of the early section, one of the early sections that was drafted. The scene immediately following it was drafted very early on. There is a hunger strike later in the book. Those scenes were drafted very early on.
And there is
a particular bombing. There are a few bombings, but there is a particular bombing in the book later on, which in the current order of the book is quite late. I say that like I'm still planning on changing the order. I'm not. I'm done, I swear. they've wrenched it away from me. Pretty late in the book, there's like a dramatic section with a bombing. And that section might be the section where the you kind of returned very strongly. So it was always in this first prologue page. And there was a point where I think, you know, I was trying to figure out who the you was. And I think I've said, maybe there are versions of this book where there were many much longer sections in New York. And she's speaking in New York in 2009. And there were points where she was talking to a particular person. And then I discovered I didn't care very much about the identity of, and that person did things and like, and then I realized I didn't care about them. And I was really struggling to write about them because I didn't care very much about them. And then I kind of cut them away and was like, oh, this is much more flexible. Now that you can be, you know, I can kind of deal with all of the presumptions about audience. I mean, I think so often people, especially with like writers from any marginalized community, they're sort of like, how do you speak to others? And, you know, they have that tone a little bit too. And, how do those in the homeland view you? And I mean, those are all valid questions, but I think, you know, at different moments we're talking to different people. And I think that writing to a particular you was helpful in early drafts. And certain sections of the book were also written for particular occasions. Like I remember that section with the bombing late in the book was written for a particular reading. And so having specific audiences, having specific audiences for certain parts, I think was really helpful, writing for particular people. But then in the end, all of that kind of fell away and the you became this kind of, this fluid thing that allowed me to kind of allow Sashi really to have a little bit of an argument with herself or with the reader about who she is, about who she might be presuming they are, what they might be presuming about her, etc.
Mm-hmm. How did she come to you? I was so taken by, because she's a medical student, she wants to be a doctor, and it really it really feels like, you know, like I found myself doing that thing that I hate people doing, which I looked into your background and I was like, well, she's surely a medical student at some point in her life, because it is so real. It is so vivid and realized. And I just want to know how her character came to you. Did she come to you? Did the brothers come to you? Was it always her?
Sure. I mean, I think definitely she and Kay were very clear before the brothers. And Kay is a friend of the brothers. And again, there's that section with the bombing later in the book. And at first it's about Sashi encounters another young woman who also has brothers. And she compares their lives. And she's sort of like, you know, she had four brothers and I had four brothers. I think the first time I wrote that story, all of Sashi's brothers died. Just all of them.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Which is, spoiler alert, not what happens in the book. Right. And and so, but she was always there, and she is interested in medicine. There were a lot of people with medical training and backgrounds, or who were thrust into those positions of caregiving over the course of the war, and I was always very interested in that opportunity / predicament.
Mm-hmm.
Because people came from all sorts of political backgrounds and had all sorts of opportunities to, and I have, you know, there are physicians in my own family, some of whom were very generous with their time and expertise. It is generally my goal to like make people think that I went to medical school. so, you know, it's like I can, it's just funny because, you know, it's the sort of Asian stereotype of like, oh, my parents always wanted to meet me to be a doctor. Instead, I've written several obsessive novels about the body. so I'm sure that I will, like, no matter what I do, that's always going to come back because I'm just sort of obsessively interested in it. And like my appetite to listen to like long descriptions of anatomy and, I don't know, methods of care and drugs and, I don't know, situations and patients and weird treatments. Like my appetite for this is really endless. So I'm aware that other people's appetites are not endless. So hopefully
I had an appetite for it. All of that. When they're talking about, I think it's the nerves in the face and how many nerves are in the face. I was loving, I mean, I love those sections. They just really, I don't know. They took me in. And what a way to really amp up the tension too, because not only is she someone whose brothers are part of the movement, but she's also being asked to help the movement. Mm-hmm. And so they play on her loyalty to her brothers, but they also play on her loyalty to medicine. And she, you know, at the end of the day, just kind of gives into that, not gives in, makes a choice that, you know, it's important to help people who need help and, you know, be able to see her brothers and Kay whenever she possibly can. But it's such a way to really heighten the tension and up the stakes just in terms of like, you know, the mechanics of writing this novel. So I don't know. Bravo.
Thank you. I think like before this, my first novel in its earliest stages, actually, I shouldn't even say in its earliest stages, until quite late in the game, like one could make a very reasonable argument that it had no plot. And so I think I've always... Like and so like, well, I think I've always really thought of myself as like, oh, you're so bad at plot, like things are never going to happen in your book. And so here I think like medicine gave me a way that people had to pick things and have arguments, and that was very handy. And then it's also like a kind of expertise that I'm very interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually kind of part of the culture that that is what the students there at that time would maybe have been dreaming of doing. And then I was able to talk to some people who had like medical school at that time was an experience that was frequently interrupted. And it could take you a really, really long time to finish. So I was able to kind of get a sense of what it was like, both from people who had gone to university at that time, and there's like some written documents about the kind of the life of the university in that period. So I was able to look at those too.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting in relation to, you know, we're with Sashi for, it's obviously so much in her life is changing. She's kind of beginning her studies as her life is thrown into complete turmoil. And the death of, is it Niranjan?
It's Niranjan.
Niranjan. Yeah, yeah, yeah. When Niranjan is killed, and Sashi's feeling towards her studies, feeling towards her own life completely shifts. It's so interesting how that allows her, her professional career to really become something she cares so much less about, and as a result becomes successful at, in a way. I can't remember the exact line, but something like the world was empty now, or, you know, now that her brother was gone, it's like that she was able to just kind of, well, this is another thing I'm going to do, and I'm going to take care of it. It was just, I loved that the awful fact of her brother's murder, I loved. Jesus Christ, what am I saying?
I know. See, I keep saying things like that too, and it's terrible.
But from just a from a character development point, it was so interesting to be with her in that before time, and to see the failure, and how the slight failure, because it was just one aspect of the testing, and just how her brother's death, unfortunately, probably was one of the root causes of her ability to just go on in medicine. I mean, it's just kind of a brutal fact of the narrative.
That's interesting. I don't know that I would have thought of it that way, and yet I think you're exactly right. I think, like, it's very common to not pass, especially in that era, like your first attempts to enter medical school, many people are not successful. And so she's really kind of not outside the norm,
right,
in her attempts, but she is comparing herself to one of the most successful students in the country. Her brother's friend, Kay, who lives down the street from them and who's a year ahead of her. And he sort of passes with flying colors, and she's sort of competitive with him. And then, yeah, I think, you know, Niranjan is the oldest brother, and he is killed fairly early in the novel. It's interesting to see actually which reviews will get into this and which ones won't. I was like, is this a spoiler? I mean, it is, but it's also almost impossible to talk about the novel without,
right,
without talking about it. He's just kind of right in, he's in medical school. So he's at the beginning of the novel, really like one of her role models. He's almost like a second father. He dotes on her. He gives her his medical textbooks. When she does fail her exams for the first time, and he gets a posting in Colombo to begin his medical career, he takes her with him. And that's how they end up in the kind of historical circumstance of the Black July riots that begin the war. And those are the circumstances under which he's killed. And she also, right, this is the moment where, like, he's not, I don't know, like, maybe this is spoilery, but, like, he doesn't die on screen.
Right.
And so he walks out the door and he doesn't come back. So I think, like, there also there's like a, she has a sense that she permitted something to happen, allowed someone to leave her view, who she should never have let out of her sight.
It's phrased that way in the novel, right? Aren't those the words that Sashi says to her father? I let him go. I mean, yeah, it's so, oh God.
I found myself like comforting myself by saying, like, well, we didn't see him die. So he just wanted to join the movement. He's not really dead. He's going to show up later because he's such an important. I know. And I did the same thing. I did the same thing when Kay died. Sorry, spoiler. I'll just tell everyone, just skip ahead. Okay. We're going to talk about spoilers. When Kay died, I found myself thinking it was a body double. He's not really dead. They wouldn't let him die. There's that wonderful tension. I really want to talk about how you build tension, because it's very subtle and delicate, the way that you build it and build it and build it and build it. And there's that moment that she has with Kay where their attraction to each other is finally not even being acknowledged, but just being witnessed by us, I guess. And I don't know, it's like kind of hot. It's like, I was like, oh yes. Okay. Like, yes. And it's masterful how you spend a lot of time like building that slowly, slowly, slowly. Cause it's, for a while, he's sort of a mentor. He's another brother. You know, like, you're not sure like how he feels about her. And then it becomes very clear that
it's from the first scene.
I know. But she's so young. I mean, she's so young when he does the eggs on her burn, you know, You guys are just gonna have to figure it out and read the book. but another moment that I felt, so as Alex and I have mentioned, and as you've mentioned, there's bombings in the book, there's death, there's just grief, there's just terrible, you know, war. And the time that I actually gasped was at the very end when she sees her brother and he asks her to do something and she says no. I don't know exactly what she says, but she refuses him. It's the moment that she just like tears her connection from him, from her brother. And I gasped because it was a huge deal, I feel, for Sashi after everything, after all the terrible things that have happened in the book. That was the moment that I felt like, oh my God, wow. And I think that's a testament to how you built that tension and how you just maintained it. And I just want to know how you did that.
Thank you. So much of this book, I'm realizing listening to you talk, was in a different order. Like there was a moment where like she just like the book started with the appointment.
Really?
And there was a moment actually when the appointment used to be with a different character too. And then I was like, I don't care about this character either. I should really make that character someone I care about. That would be a good idea. And so I'm like, I've always kind of joked that I should teach a class called Enormous Plot Changes at the Last Minute.
I would take it.
And it's really fun to kind of be like, wouldn't the scene be worse if I put this character who's more important there instead of that character who's actually kind of peripheral? And so there is a character in the book named T who is, and his full name is not ever revealed, kind of like K's. And he used to be in some of the situations that Celan is now in. And so you can see the ways that, like, obviously if it's her brother, it just matters more. So, and then I think, so I also, maybe at this point it might be like 4 or 5 years ago, but Leslie Arima, who's another fiction writer, lives in Minneapolis and had read some of this. And I think that my work was kind of, and maybe this is still true, but like a lot of it is kind of animated by regret. And like, this could have gone differently. You know, kind of just like all of this could have been different. And that's the title of a very successful book this year. And like, so the Leslie was kind of like, have you considered not giving away the ending to everything? And just how you order. Have you considered writing your book in the order in which it happens? and I was like, this is so obvious. And also bless you for saying this to me because it had somehow never occurred to me to tell it in order. And that just instantly made everything easier. And I realized that I was doing like a pale Andace imitation by making it all chopped up and non-linear. And like the kind of detective work that is interesting in this story is not to the detective work of like, when did this happen? Or like, how did the characters get from this point to this? Like, why are these two things in this time relation? It is actually just following the tension of what my agent calls like the frog boiling very slowly in water in this book. But I really had to have Leslie kind of, and she said it so gently, just like, I don't know, just everything about the sentences, it was always like, and this character looking at that character did not yet know how they would be torn apart later. And I don't know, it was a bit much. So like it had plenty of tension without that. So I am very grateful to her for saying that.
I'm so surprised to hear that, Sugi, because I feel like there's such a density of events in this novel. I mean, it's just so much happens on a month and, you know, a month to month scale. And a lot of the chapters are oriented that way in sections of months. You know, we're progressing through the mid 80s to the late 80s for the majority of the book. And it's like month to month, year by year. It seems like it would be so much harder to do this out of order, especially using the armature of real events or real touch points like that. It's so wild.
I feel like it's really speaking to me because I literally just had that revelation about my novel. What I was trying to do was trying to show you something that happened and then give you the bittersweet of what things used to be, you know, but it wasn't landing, you know, like I was trying to show like, okay, this horrible thing happened. Now let's go back and look at what, you know, like what used to be so you can see what they've given up. But I think unless it's necessary, it just doesn't land, you know? I mean, it wasn't landing for me and it sounds like it wasn't landing for you either. Cause I was doing a lot of the same things that you're saying you were doing, which was like, but one day they would find out that the da 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 da, or that was before that, you know? And it's just a lot of like wheel spinning, or it felt like that for me.
I think what I wanted was to avoid the incredibly complicated story math that is required by this story. Like somehow if I told it out of order, I could like confuse people out of caring about like whether it's plausible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so like a very early example of me like fucking this up. Am I allowed to swear on the show?
Yes.
Okay, good news. like I, in a very early version, when Kay was responsible for another character's death, but then in another scene, that character also did his autopsy. Mm-hmm. You cannot do your assassin's autopsy. It's a logical problem. And this is like another one of the reasons Sashi exists, because I essentially kind of like split that character. I was like, that character has to be two people because you can't do your assassin's autopsy. And like the like cause and effect here has to work differently, but you can only really deal with cause and effect if you have to know what order your events happen in, and I apparently was not going to know that unless I wrote it in order.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What was the nature of the research necessary for you to do to write this novel, and as you were drafting, how did you bring it into your actual sentence making?
That's a great question.
It really is. Dang, Alex. Good job.
Bringing it into your sentence making. I think that like so much of composition is unconscious, but I'll try and kind of reverse engineer that version. I think that there's a lot of space around the official versions of things to imagine what might have happened. And also in Sashi, I was imagining a point of view that definitely, like, I was inventing her. She was plausible, but I was inventing her. So I felt a lot of freedom with her. I did an enormous amount of research, probably even research I don't remember doing. Like, I mean, I spent so long on it that I just, I think that I ended up knowing certain parts of it so well that in the moments when I was writing those sections, I didn't have to think that much. But I also had an enormous number of readers who had lived through those time periods or who studied those time periods as scholars. And those people also read the book, and I felt very accountable to them. So I shared my drafts with a lot of the people in the acknowledgments. It doesn't necessarily say like this person read a draft for me, but a huge number of them did.
Wow.
And so I just kind of wasn't, I mean, I also had 20 years in which to ask people. So, you know, at any one time, like maybe two or three people were reading it. And I mean, this ranged anywhere from like the audiobook came out today. We're recording on January 17th, and the audiobook came out in North America today. And the narrator of the audiobook, Nirmala Rajasingham, lived through this time period. Wow. And so she,
remember, you were so excited that you got her, right? I mean, this was a huge deal.
I am so excited. Like, she has never done an audiobook before. I don't know that she'll ever do one again. She has an astonishing voice now. Sashi, based on her background, should have like a slight Jaffna / British English, like Sri Lankan English accent. Mm-hmm. And if I did that, I would feel like I was putting it on. But Nirmala has the right, she just in every way is perfect to read it. to the point that like I now almost feel like I should be reading the book myself. I should just play clips from the audiobook because that is what Sashi would sound like. It is really great. And she also was involved, like she's an ex-militant. She has lived and continues to live a very politically engaged life. And so I felt accountable to people like her. You know, I have another friend who, when I did decide to start writing the book in order, would read each chapter as I wrote it. And wow. We would have a conversation every day. And then if I didn't send her a chapter the next day, she would yell at me in the best way. But she would just be like, where's the chapter? She would call me and be like, where's your chapter?
Before we move on, Sugi, I want to hear, can you tell us how you got, is it Nirmala? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Can you tell us the story of how you got her to do this? Just because if she'd never done it before, and obviously it was such an amazing fit.
Well, I think Nirmala and I have been friends for a long time. We were introduced by other mutual friends. And, you know, I think I must have met her in New York it might have been 2007, 2008. And off and on over the years, I have seen her. I've followed her kind of public appearances. And so I'm also aware from talking to her, she has kind of theatrical training. So, and then also I didn't know off the top of my head anyone else who was sort of age appropriate and who had lived through this time period who would have that kind of training, who would be perfect to this. So it's not like, right, you're sitting around with a ton of options. And then also it was really important to me that it be someone from Jaffna, which is where the book is set, who was going to read it. And Nirmala, I mean, if I had had a ton of options, Nirmala would have still have been the best one. Like I feel so fortunate that she was willing to do this. And I think that because she has that, she has an arts background. And she was one of the people who, you know, if I would get kind of bogged down in my research, she'd be like, I would be like, is this accurate? And she'd be like, well, she's like, you have creative license. And I'd be like, why are you telling me this? she was not actually the person most concerned with my, I mean, if I was inaccurate and she felt like it was important, she would tell me, but she honored kind of the imaginative space of the story. So,
what a gift.
Yeah. I'm very lucky that she said yes. I'm very lucky that Random House was not like I explained to her, I was sort of like, this is who she is. Please, 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 please. And they listened, and that was also amazing. So I'm very grateful.
That's awesome.
It's not always what happens.
I just learned that today that you started writing it in 2004, which blew my mind because that's before the Civil War even ended. So what was it like to start a book and then 5 years into writing it, you know, the Civil War that you're writing about ends? What was that like?
Sure. So the book starts with the book began, like some of the earliest pages were the hunger strike, which was a bit of research I had stumbled on and working on my first novel, which came out in 2008. So between, like, especially between 2006, 2007, I had kind of put this aside and gone back to my first book. And then I was promoting that book and the war ended. And in that book, the war doesn't end. So that book came out in April 2008, and then I was kind of on tour with it or reading in different places. And in May 2009, the war ended. And so I went back to this book, and they had been sold at the same time. And I kind of knew, like, of course, this is a different animal now. And I had, I think, like a lot of Sri Lankans, probably particularly people from minority communities, and have a lot of thoughts and feelings about the end of the war. And mm-hmm. So I knew that those would end up in there somehow. But yeah, I mean, definitely like a lot of fumbling around in weird history early on without having a sense of where it was going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I published another novel in there. All sorts of stuff happened. It's not like I was necessarily looking at it every day.
Right.
But I think in my brain, I looked at it every day.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Same agent the whole time, Sugi?
Yes, I have had the same extraordinarily patient agent the whole time.
That's amazing.
Amazing.
Isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think you know, recently we had a guest. I think she'd had 6 or 7 agents over the course of her career. Unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah. I think some people are more comfortable just being like, yeah, I'm going to try something else now. You know, we had someone on who told his agent, Andrew Lipstein told his agent, you know what? I'm just going to try to go out on with this on my own. And he sold it himself.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Wow. Yeah.
Under a pseudonym.
Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah. So Lindsay and I were exchanging texts today, just getting ready to talk to you. And we had already talked so much about the book, but neither of us had read the recent article essay you had written for Time about your hands and losing the full use of your hands late in the drafting of this novel. And we were wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe the response that piece has gotten, or if there has been any kind of outreach from other writers who have had similar experiences or anything like that.
Sure. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised that it was, out of all the pre-publication things that I wrote, it probably is the one that got the most response. And for me, the story of my hands is kind of like, it's a long story. It's really a longer story than could have fit into that essay, because I've had hand injuries off and on since I was like a tween. Mm. Partly because I was a tennis player and partly because I'm a klutz. And so I did get, in response to that piece, just some people who were sort of like, I had a hand problem and I was helped by this person or technique or center or treatment. And I just wanted to share that information with you. And so, you know, generally, I would write back and sort of say, thanks so much, I'll check it out. But I really got a whole range of responses, from like specific physical therapist recommendations to, you know, some people just commiserating. I have a friend from college who wrote to me like maybe the day before yesterday. And he has known me since, like, in college, I had hand issues as well. And he's like, oh, I remember what your hands were like, and I didn't realize it had progressed in this way. And then he said when he was writing his first book, he had permanently damaged his hands. And wow. I have seen him since then, but I had no idea.
Wow.
So he said that now he uses like a certain tool. And I was like, I didn't know that tool existed. So I think the next time he and I see each other, we'll have a lot to catch up about. So yeah, like a lot of, I don't know, there's also like, there's a way in which you can kind of receive unsolicited medical advice.
Have you tried Icy Hot?
Exactly. Are you familiar with Bengay? And I think I sort of chose like very consciously not to bristle at some of it, because so much of it was like people who had, and people who were sufferers of chronic pain, or people who are dealing with chronic pain, and who I have seen write about their pain on social media. And whose histories I have been following, whose information I have been glad to receive in that other way. So yeah, like if it was helpful to anyone. And then the other weird thing that happened was, did you guys see that Hanif Qureshi had a fall?
No. What?
So he lives, I think he was in Rome, which maybe is where he lives. I'm not sure. And so he had a terrible fall of some kind, and he is now in a medical situation where he cannot type. And so I think it was like this happened like the day that the article came out. So then I also started getting messages from people who were like, do you know Hanif Qureshi? And can we send him your article? And I was like, my article is on the internet. I'm terribly sorry that this has happened to him. 100%. If you think it's helpful to him and not, like, so he was seeking out this information.
Whoa.
Jesus.
And so I think it got sent to him, and I hope that it's helpful. And I feel like, I think that he must, from this, he's been tweeting about it. I think possibly someone else must be typing the tweets for him, or I don't know, maybe he's using the adaptive technology. I'm not totally sure. But yeah, your listeners can like go look at his feed, and he sort of says, does anyone know anything about this?
Wow.
Jeez. So that was the sort of curious timing of that. Was quite weird.
The part that struck me the most is how you said, you know, your hands are able to move the way your mind moves, you know, like they're typing along with the rhythm of what your, you know, your mind is doing as you're writing. But so you've had to learn how to redo that. And it struck me because that's exactly, you know, how I write. And Alex said, that's exactly how he writes, you know, your hands move with the way that your mind is moving as you're typing. You know, like we don't write longhand. So like having to adapt to using your voice, which is such a different feeling, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And learning, you know, to trust your students who, you know, who help you, who helped you with these, you know, the final drafts of Brotherless Night. Is that how you write now? Are you dictating? Are you,
It's often a mix. I think actually it's basically since that in the past couple of weeks, I think I've been a little bit complacent about managing how I use my hands. And so actually in the past probably like 4 or 5 days, I really have jacked them up in some funky way. Mm-hmm. So like tomorrow, you know, the scribes put their availability on a calendar and I probably have to book someone for tomorrow because I could type, but it's really not a good idea. Mm-hmm. And definitely I have to also have some self-discipline about like, if the dog looks at me and she's really cute, I shouldn't pick her up.
Oh man.
That's so hard.
It's actually, I'm sure that that's a lot of what has happened in the past few days. I'm just sort of like, she's like, I need attention. And I'm like, yeah. I hug you. I carry you around the house like a baby. Like, it's a bad idea. Ugh. And she's can only get, 10 pounds.
Can you get like a baby Bjorn you can put her in and then she can be like in the front pack?
I should do that. I mean,
that's
I think
a
that's
good idea.
A sling.
That's a good idea.
I've seen dogs in slings before, you know, and then she's just right there with you.
I think that would maybe be more realistic than my developing the willpower to like not pick her up at all.
I can't imagine. I mean, that's one of the purest pleasures in life, holding your dog, right? Like you can't deprive yourself of that.
I think so. I mean, I've never had a pet before and she's like she's just my favorite. So, yeah. But I think sort of constantly like the past several days have been like a reminder that I need to not kind of screw around because it's very easy to re-injure myself, which I clearly have done. So or just to kind of exacerbate things.
If anyone that listens makes dog slings, please hit Sugi up.
call me.
Also, if you're not making dog slings, what the fuck are you guys doing? Can you please just get on that and help our buddy out here? What's going on?
Honestly, I don't know why I haven't. Well, Sugi, this has been such a pleasure. We loved your book. So excited that it's out and so excited that people are reading it and responding as, you know, strongly as they are. And now I really have to go listen to the audio because I really want to hear Sashi's voice for myself. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me. I love your show and it's such a pleasure to talk to be read so thoughtfully and carefully and to get such great questions. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sugi. This was a blast.
See you later. See you in your dog sling.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What an amazing book.
It's a huge swing, and you know it is right away, and she pulls it off. It's awesome.
Pathetic that I didn't know anything about the Sri Lankan Civil War beforehand.
Well, I mean, I didn't either. I think probably many readers of this book are the same. And it's why one of the reasons why the you works so well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are appropriately implicated by it.
Yep.
We being you and me. And it's a great book. I love that material that is so horrific and dense with events, as I said earlier, it doesn't read that way at all. Like you said, it is a page turner. There is incredible romantic sexual tension throughout the whole book. There is like deep familial love, and just Sugi is really brilliant writing about family. Clearly there's a nuance to relationships between Sashi and her brothers that is rare to read, I think.
Yeah.
And the fact that she has so many brothers.
Exactly.
And their relationships are so different. It's, it's incredible writing.
It is. I know, because I feel like I've written things in the past where I'm like, oh, yeah, there's that other sibling.
Right.
Like, who, what?
Right.
You know, exactly. Like, they are very different. And, you know, their impact on the narrative is different. And yeah, it's a great read.
Yeah.
And an important read.
Yep. I think a lot of people are going to really connect with this book, and rightly so.
How was your week? And your week. How was your week?
Week was good, I think. I don't know. Everybody's been sick, but that's been the story for the past couple of years. So starting to get a little bit better. I had a good day today. I feel like the girls had a good day today. I don't know if you're that way. I am this way, where if it's like a good day with the kids and they are feeling happy and having fun and laughing, it's like, okay, that was a good day. That was fine.
Yeah. It's like when you feel like you're not doing a bad job.
Yes. That's it. That's exactly it. It's like, okay, you know, obviously with young kids, no day goes perfectly, but it's like, I didn't fuck up too bad today. Kids are happy. They're fed. They're clean. This is great. This is good.
Yeah. Like, there'll be a moment where I'm like, oh, if I was just like a little bit more tired, I would have yelled at my kid about that. But here I am being like, hey, in the future, can you make sure to blah, 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 you know, and like really vibing with my children, and the household, you know, is not too dirty. And, you know, like, I've got my shit together. But it's easy to fall into the trap of being like, okay, I figured it out. And then the next day you're like,
no. That is not a thought I usually have.
No, I think I just get too disappointed in myself when the inevitable switch happens.
Right. Yep.
There's just like a lot of them, and they all have their own anxieties and fears, and they all need their mom.
Everybody needs their mom, for sure.
And one of them doesn't think that the other two should have the same mom.
Oh my god, my girls do that too, where they're obsessed with like, dad is my dad, mom is your mom, or mom is like, or whatever, all this stuff. And it's so funny watching kids learn about how and why we are related to each other.
Like,
parse it out. It's amazing.
Like, I'll be comforting Towns because he like fell or something. And Judith will come over and try to like insert herself in between us. Be like, no, this is not your mom. This is my mom. It's rough. Anyway, but they're great. They're great. Nobody has a running.
Of course they're great.
Yeah.
How was your week or whatever? Since we last talked?
I got so much done last week.
It's awesome.
Because, you know, it was like the first week they were back in school.
Right.
Like, Ben wasn't dead.
He was like, Ben's alive.
So I really felt like a human being again. But I remembered that we never talked about, so I had like this big edit that I had to do on my novel and send it back.
Yes, quickly.
Time. Yeah, like really quickly. And I was terrified. Like, Thanksgiving was in the middle of that, and we had like a trip planned. And I just didn't have the time that I wanted to have. And I also was having a hard time like reconnecting with it.
Yeah.
Like, the whole thing just seemed wrong. Whereas like before, when I would look at it, I was connected and I could see where it was going. And like, I just could not understand what the hell I was seeing. Like, it just didn't seem right to me. And, so I just like kept trying to force my way in and like hack my way in, and it would end up where I would just like, I deleted like 15 to 20,000 words of it.
It's a lot,
especially in that short period of time. And she wanted me to write 15,000 more than what I had, so that was going to be like a lot that I would have to like rewrite and rework.
So you're saying you were, after your changes, you were like 30,000 words in the hole,
plus I owed her 15 to 20 on top of that.
Jesus.
I don't know, but so I was just like, I'm doomed. Like, I don't know what I don't know what's wrong with me. Why did I think this was a book? You know, like, this is devastating. Like, I'm an idiot, you know? And like, poor Roxanne just trying to throw me a bone. Mm-hmm. Like, and now her reputation's on the line. But so I just
you
kept
ruined your life.
I ruined her life and my life. Mm-hmm. But I had a breakthrough. I shout out Megan Phillips. She talked about how she was going to start reading O Caledonia. Mm-hmm. And I had seen other people talking about it. So I was like, all right, I'll pick up a copy of that. And I read the first page and it was like a light switch went on. And I was like, I found my way back in. And I just knew exactly what I needed to do. I knew exactly the story, how it needed to be reshaped. And like I was saying to Sugi, like before everything was sort of out of order, mm-hmm. I was trying to highlight different things, but it wasn't succeeding. And I realized like, oh, this should be in order. Like this story should, you know, the tension, the crime that happens is it's already built in. Now I just need, anyway, so I have kept O Caledonia amazing. On my desk ever since. I mean, I read the whole book. I loved it. And there's like a lot of permissions in there for me personally. And then I don't know. Then I was just like, I was able to get it done. And thank God. I mean, maybe it's trash. Maybe when I see it again, I'll be like, oh no.
No, it's not trash. Come on.
But that's
amazing.
Related to that author who ended up plagiarizing half her book. Like, cause she didn't know what to do. And she just opened up a book and started typing what was there. And I was like, I can understand why she did that now.
Oh, give me a fucking break.
Well, no, I literally had that moment. I mean, I know it's different, but I did have that moment where I was like, you know what? There's this like a shade of like terror and like, and not knowing what to do where I could see, like, I just want to see what it feels like to write something that works. So let me write out something that works. I didn't ever do it, but I could totally. And another thing, I read Jack Jem's book, and Jack's going to come on our podcast, Empty Theater. And there's like and that book's bonkers in a great way.
Please give me the full title, please.
I can't. There's no way I could tell you the full title. The full title is a page long. But there's like a wacky chapter where she basically just, and it's near the end of the book. She has never done it until this moment. Steps aside and addresses you and talks to you about the choices that were just made. And I didn't do that in my book, but it gave me permission into it, like another way of doing something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So the answer is reading. The answer is always reading, not plagiarizing, but reading.
It's funny because what you were just saying and something that Sugi said in our interview when she was saying, oh, I should teach a class about making big changes late in editing or whatever. I actually am teaching a class that is very similar to that. And I'm teaching a class that is partly about staying open to making changes in your narrative and how that is different than writing plotless work or structureless work. And I think that is such an important ability and also just a recognition that it's different. Okay. Yes, you may not know where you're going, but that's different than not having a plan, or it's different than being lost.
Right.
You know, whatever the quotidian aspect of that is, like the day-to-day experience of that, it's like you wrote this novel, like, and you've already edited this novel. Like you were so close to the material and caring so much at this stage of editing that you were in like a crisis, but that doesn't mean that you're actually lost. It just means that you're trying to, it's like you had one map and now you're looking for the map that's like inside the map.
Totally. And for me, it was like, where am I? Who am I? You know,
where
like
am I?
When I'm me, and I'm writing my little words, I know what I'm doing, you know, like even when I don't know where it's going. But I couldn't find me. I couldn't find my foothold. And that was really scary, you know. It was really scary. And
of course.
I just, like, carried that around with me forever. And had to like do Thanksgiving and, you know, like, and be a mom and, you know, like carry this like darkness. But there was a way out. I just had to find it.
It is such a weird feeling, I say, to go back to something you spent so long on and have it be just strange to you. Just like, wait, yeah, what is this? What, like, not remembering the chain of decision making,
right,
that would lead to a certain rhythm or series of decisions, and then like finally arriving at it and being like, oh, okay, now I remember what I was doing. But yeah, it is so disorienting. I'm going through a little bit of that right now. I kind of got through it, but
I was wondering.
Yeah, it's been an interesting experience. It's been fun because I really had not looked at it since, I mean, even way before it sold. Like, mm-hmm, basically the entire time it was on submission, I hadn't looked at it. So it was a long time.
It's too painful.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not looking at this. So yeah, it's been interesting. But yeah.
Do you know the day yours is coming out yet?
Mm-mm. No, okay. I don't.
Neither do I. But it will eventually. Yeah, I read Kevin Maloney's book, The Redheaded Pilgrim.
Awesome. I'm excited. That's next up to read, obviously, for me. Yeah.
It is so funny. And yeah, I have a lot of topics for him. So
yeah, it'll be really fun to talk to him.
Yep, Kevin. Also, like, why? This is one of my questions for him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I laughed along with it. I love it every time I see it. But why is a woman's bush, the size of her bush, always like the joke? Why can't it be the man's bush?
That's a great question.
It's never like, and he had a giant bush. It's always the woman.
In fact, I don't think I've ever even heard it called a man's bush.
Yeah.
That's, I mean.
Thatch? I don't know.
God, look at that guy's butch. Or butch. Oh, that's what it can be called, a butch.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's kind of cute. That's gender norm, kind of.
Look at that guy's butch.
And I read Juan Martinez's, friend of the pod, Juan Martinez's Extended Stay, which just came out. Oh,
yeah, I got to pick that up.
And that book is crazy.
Really?
It is. It's horror and gore. And what? Yeah. Oh, awesome. Yeah. Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, especially if you like speculative, you know, like what?
No, I don't. Happening. But I love Juan.
No, I mean he pulls it off. And
Juan is an incredible writer. I would read anything he wrote. I mean, I don't even like horror, but I said awesome because it's Juan.
Because it's Juan. I mean, I talked to him like early on in me reading it, and I was like, "This book's crazy. I can't believe it." And he was like, "Lindsay, just so you know, it gets so much worse, and it does."
I can imagine him saying that like very politely, very like, hey, just so you know, yeah, it gets a lot worse.
That's what he said, and he was right. But yeah, so if you like Juan, but also if you like horror and gore and speculative fiction and like violence, and I mean at its core it's about grief. So you know, it's,
do you like grief?
Literary. If you like grief, I don't know what I'm saying, but I enjoyed it a lot. And I'm going to talk to him about it next week at a book.
Yeah, at your other job, right?
At my other hosting job. If only I got paid for these things.
Another one in the books.
Oh, pun intended.
It actually wasn't. That's how fucking stupid I am.
All right.
Talk to you later. Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Hickley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.
Yeah, yeah!